Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter. A warm welcome to our listeners. Thank you for tuning in. In today's podcast, we're going to be discussing youth engagement, regional cooperation, and climate justice in the Caribbean and small island developing states with Christian Zakor, an advocate for environmental governance and climate justice from Trinidad and Tobago. Welcome, Christian.
Thanks, Alex.
So let's maybe start today's podcast by setting the scene a little bit. So we'll specifically talk about the Caribbean as well, but let's start maybe a little bit broader. The small island developing states are a group of small island countries that share similar sustainable development challenges. Can you start us off by giving an overview of some of these key challenges and how climate change compounds some of these vulnerabilities?
Okay, so small island developing states are, as the name implies, they are small. Their islands and their developing states. So because of the status, they can be physically isolated. For example, Hawaii, as well as many of the Pacific Islands, they're very far from other nations. Because they're small islands, they will have a low resource base, which includes land. So you'll have competition for land, you'll have competition for water resources. You can also have arguments over keeping land forested instead of making it into something usable in the immediate short term. They usually have fragile marine and terrestrial ecosystems. You'll often see things like coral reefs and fields of seagrass around small islands. And due to all of these factors, it's small population size as well. Some countries, some small islands will have populations that are comparable to a medium-sized United States town, for example, 600,000 people. It's very small. And this makes us very vulnerable to exogenous shocks. You see problems with economies of scale. We can't benefit from cost advantages because we don't have a wide base of resources. Small domestic markets, local producers will usually try to target exports, and they usually have to pay a lot for it because of transports or demand. The cost of provision for energy, transport, infrastructure, communications are usually high. Our internet comes from undersea fiber optic cables, which is interesting, but that actually makes them prone to environmental disruptions. And there's a heavy reliance on tourism and services. Some islands will set themselves apart because they have different sectors. Like Jamaica has been exploring ICT, which is interesting. It's really cool to have that diversification of the markets, but they still have tourism as a reliance. And in this new century of climate change, it's a problem because climate change is an existential threat. It's cross-cutting. It's not just going to affect the environment. It affects our economy and our society as well. And indeed our personal human security, I guess. I think the best way to illustrate the climate crisis on small island developing states is to look at the effect of the pandemic, where countries shut down entirely. We had no money coming out. People were trapped in their homes. They couldn't go out and make money for themselves and improve the economy. And we can very easily extend the impact of the pandemic to think about the climate crisis in the next 50 years.
So you've mentioned a lot of different countries that are definitely not in the same regional focus, which of course is part of SIDS. And also when you talk about this kind of isolated nature, a lot of these island countries, I want to touch on regional cooperation a little bit. So to start off with a little bit of background, maybe states that part of SIDS are grouped into three geographic regions. So you have one, the Caribbean, two, the Pacific, and then three is Africa, Indian Ocean, Mediterranean, and South China Sea. And there's also regional cooperation bodies like the Caribbean Community, Pacific Island Forum, Indian Ocean Commission, as well as the Alliance of Small Island States. How does regional cooperation work amongst these different groups? Is there a lot of knowledge sharing that's happening? And how are these exchanges facilitated if that does happen?
I will say that I have personally not seen much inter-regional collaboration.
Interesting.
Which is a shame because we're so similar. when I went to COP27, I met Pacific people and I realized, except for things like languages and our dress, we're very similar. But even though we don't have much, I wouldn't say mechanisms, really much happening in terms of the interregional collaboration, I have seen still some form of knowledge sharing. For example, last year in the Commission on the Status of Women, there was a high-level event that was organized to showcase women from the Caribbean and the Pacific who are championing climate finance and the Ocean Climate Nexus. There is some knowledge sharing, just not in the official capacity. I want to give some props to AOSIS, the Alliance of Small Island States, which is more of an intergovernmental organization comprising representatives from governments, and their fellowship will also train young people from these islands how to negotiate. And it represents 39 low-lying and vulnerable coastal nations. And it's meant to consolidate voices to become one, to give power, basically. There's power in numbers. Yeah. And by unifying these small islands together, you have one body who can fight on behalf of all of us.
There's a lot of progress and like unifying spirit behind the Alliance of Small Island States, and maybe in the future, more opportunities for different forms of knowledge sharing, whether it be amongst formal channels or kind of informal channels in international spaces like COPs or different conferences and things like that.
I think there could be a lot more because we are similar. We have different strengths that we can easily combine. The opportunity is there, and I'd like to see it happen.
Nice. Hopefully then in the next few years, we'll have you sooner than the next few years, maybe have you on for a follow-up podcast. But hopefully in the future, we can touch upon maybe some progress made in terms of these exchanges. So I also want to talk a little bit about your work as a project officer with the Caribbean Philanthropic Alliance. And one of the Alliance's core goals is to harness financial and other resources to accelerate the achievement of the SDGs by 2030, coming up very soon. And I was reading that one of the core projects is the Caribbean Tree Planting Project. Maybe you could speak a little bit about how the project is important in terms of not only climate protection, but also for creating momentum for collective action.
So the Caribbean Tree Planting Project is our flagship project. It was launched in 2020, and the aim was to plant 1 million trees across the Caribbean by World Environment Day 2021. And we met that goal just 3 weeks late. And it's a huge number to think about, 1 million trees that we planted in 1 year.
Congrats. That's very impressive.
Thank you. This number is, of course, not consistent across the islands. Haiti was actually the country that planted the most. They planted 500,000. This was in partnership with farmers, which goes to show you can't do everything by yourself. You have to partner with the people who know what they're doing. The project has since been extended, and we just want to keep it going with that momentum. We're now close to 2 million trees at this point. And the reason why we're doing this is not specifically just to sequester carbon, because trees are great. They offer us a lot in terms of the ecosystem services, but they cannot sequester that huge amount of carbon that we are putting out into the atmosphere because there's just not enough land space in the world to do that. So the Caribbean Tree Planting Project focuses on the different benefits that trees offer us besides just carbon sequestration. Things like food security, we put a lot of emphasis on using native forests and food trees. We use a lot of breadfruit, for example, which if you haven't had it, it's delicious. We also focus on supporting community resilience. We train people. We invite people to join us on our tree plantings. We educate young people and teach them to become ambassadors. The project demonstrates the ability to mobilize community-based action. It's very important for resilience that you can give people that sense of empowerment that they can lift themselves out of this situation. And we have a lot of proof from different islands how the Caribbean Tree Planting Project has benefited them in some way, usually financial. For example, one of our partners is an organization called Trees That Feed in Haiti. They have a lot of work done in Haiti, but they operate across the Caribbean. And they deal with mostly breadfruits. Trees That Feed has provided a lot of young women and old women in Haiti with machinery and with training to take breadfruit and turn it into breadfruit flour. And they've begun putting out Haitian cookie that's made with breadfruit flour. I can't remember the name right now, but I really want to try it.
Amazing. Yeah, if you find out the name, share it so we can spread the knowledge.
This was especially relevant when Haiti had an earthquake 2 or 3 years ago. It's very important for them to be able to use that resource to start the resilience from the inside out.
So One of the reasons I was so looking forward to having you on is to talk about youth engagement, which I think is a topic that actually the podcast hasn't really covered since it was first started. And you recently, correct me if I'm wrong, but you recently served a term on the steering committee of the UNEP Major Group of Children and Youth, right?
Yes, I did.
Okay, cool. And so that's an independent and self-organized youth constituency for UNEP. How has this group been able to steer environmental policy and governance within UNEP? And I would also be interested to know how this work on this kind of level differs from some of the Caribbean-specific and more local groups that you've been involved with.
So to give you a wider picture, the United Nations has something called a major group system. You'll have major group of women, major group of farmers, major group of NGOs. And within that, you have the major group for children and youth. And within that, you have groups like YOMBO. There's one that looks at this desertification. I think there's about 9 or 10 different constituencies within that UN major group of children and youth. And one of them is a constituency to UNEP. And all of us, we generally have the same goal, which is to empower young people and give them that space to campaign towards the United Nations. Within the UNEP MGCY, it's specifically to UNEP. And I have to say we started in 2019, because originally it was called TUNSA previously. When it was TUNSA, it was actually organized by UNEP, but now it's completely independent and self-organized. We invite young people to be a part of the constituency, and they are given opportunities like taking part in negotiations like the Committee of Permanent Representatives, open-ended working groups. We recently sent 2 young people to Thailand to work on a specific open-ended working group. There's a huge contingency of young people who have attended the United Nations Environment Assembly, which is the highest environmental negotiation event in the world, the biggest. And in fact, every time that youth is mentioned in the outcomes, we celebrate. We take a screenshot, we share it in our WhatsApp groups, and everybody starts to cheer and clap and send emojis. It's really a wonderful thing to see young people come together in this kind of way. It's especially valuable because for the most part, everything is virtual. And I joined in the beginning of 2020, just before the pandemic, and everybody was online anyway. So it wasn't out of the ordinary to have this completely virtual constituency, with the exception of some in-person events that people organize in their countries, or they go to conferences and forums. The main campaigning that we do towards UNEP is within the negotiations, but we also have some isolated opportunities here and there for young people to do things like be authors for their jury reports. These things aren't scheduled, of course. You'd have to be in a constituency on the mailing list to be aware of them. And in terms of our greater work, we have also done a lot of efforts on capacity building. In fact, the Environmental Law Working Group planning some trainings on, I think it's nearly 20 different environmental agreements, which covers the oldest ones from Stockholm, this Ramsar Convention, all the way up to the newest biodiversity beyond natural borders or natural jurisdiction, BBNJ, which concerns oceans. And I'm so happy that we're still coming up with these ways to protect the environment, which shows that you can't just have a single concrete way. You have to think holistically. The way that this differs from Caribbean organizations is that, first of all, Caribbean organizations usually don't work virtually unless they are operating across different islands as a network.
Fair. I guess with small states, then it really enables you, like with that local community, to be able to actually meet in person when it's safe to do so on a regular basis.
It's so much nicer.
Yeah, a little bit of coffee, a little bit of cake, and getting down to business.
I have a colleague who actually does that. She has an initiative called Kairi Initiatives, and she organizes community meetups every month for people to come and have refreshments and talk about environmental issues in Trinidad and Tobago.
Amazing.
Webinars don't do that.
It's true. Like running to get a coffee before your meeting and joining a webinar, and then in the background, having your email, having different notifications on your screen. That's amazing when you can meet in person and actually like very energizing to do it that way when possible.
I don't think I finished the question.
No, I didn't. I think I interrupted you.
I like our little tangents.
Yeah, little tangents are fun. We're real people having a real conversation.
So to bring it back to the question, organizations in the Caribbean tend to operate in person a lot more than virtual, with the exception of the networks or people working across different islands. I'd like to give some recognition to the Caribbean Philanthropic Alliance as well for carrying out two sessions of a Caribbean Tree Planting Week. The one that happened last year took place in October, entirely virtual, with the exception of a final day, which was filmed in a studio with broadcast live. We had hundreds of people attending, over 50 speakers, and it was really quite successful. In the Caribbean as well, there's a focus on grassroots solutions working from the ground up within our communities. And you don't tend to see much negotiations or campaigning happening at the multilateral level. It's usually within the communities or towards local governments.
So when talking about youth involvement and empowerment, I also just want to highlight its necessity for youth to be involved. And I think a lot of youth get involved because they don't really have the privilege to ignore the ongoing situation. Oftentimes, just by generations, they're the people who have, in terms of age groups, of course, contributed the least to carbon emissions, but their future is very much the most under threat as an important part of not only intergenerational justice, but also climate justice. And what additional facets of climate justice would you say are central to understanding this climate security, which can often sound very, not high level, but you don't often think of maybe human security or people's livelihoods when you hear just terms like security offhand, but what additional facets of climate justice do you think are central to understanding the situation in the Caribbean?
Climate justice is fundamentally built on a foundation of equity, ethics, and human rights. And of course, it's meant to look at justice for historical emissions and current emissions and who takes responsibility, who pays for the effects of climate change. So we can think about justice, climate justice, and we can break it down. So there's procedural justice, who's at the table. You tend to see this reference a lot when youth come into the picture. We actually use the terminology, who is at the table. Distributional justice, so the distribution of responsibilities, capacities, costs and benefits of climate action. I would personally relate this to the UNFCCC common but differentiated responsibilities, in the sense that we all have to work together, but not everybody is going to have that same kind of responsibility. There's recognition justice, recognizing and taking action to address structural constraints. Corrective justice, providing remedies for past injustices. You can easily think about this like climate finance, which could be a way to remedy the past, but also to show unity. And intergenerational, young people, which is recognizing rights to pollute and leaving options that will allow future generations to adapt. This is interesting because the right to pollute, you never think about having a right to pollute. You think about reducing pollution. But honestly, humans, no matter what we do, even going back to the early dawn of civilizations, humans will pollute. We will have a negative impact on the environment. We can tell that there was a civilization because of the waste that they left behind, methane heaps, for example. So climate justice is quite a diverse field. It's not just a flat word. It's very vibrant. It has a lot of facets to it. I don't really want to pick and choose because it's all important.
Fair enough. I think we should take all of it.
I want to mention, however, before we move on to the next question, within the Caribbean specifically, we have something called the Escazo Agreements, which is the access to information, public participation, and justice in environmental matters agreements that is specifically for Latin American Caribbean. It entered into force in 2021. There's 25 signatures. I think it's 12 countries, 25 signatures, something so. And on that, we have 10 Caribbean countries who have signed to recognize this agreement, which is great. But it does not include my country. We have not signed it. We have not.
Trinidad and Tobago is not on there yet.
No. To this day, we still have a lot of advocacy with getting the outside countries to sign on and accede to the agreements. It's going to take a lot of work, but I think it's really important for conservation, for environment, and overall for climate justice.
Definitely. And before I let you go, we are going to come back to the topic of climate justice. But I have one question that's a little bit outside the flow of our conversation, but I always really like asking different guests, especially when they're more involved with grassroots movements and grassroots organizations. So one call that we often hear in kind of this climate security community is the need for more and better data on climate risks, which is something that is costly but can also have important impacts like informing early warning systems and subsequently then early action. Does this ring true to your experience, wanting this need for more and better data? Or do you think that this call can sometimes miss the mark a little bit on the urgency of the need to take action like now and act on the data that we do have?
I think that these two are not mutually exclusive. I think that we can focus on both at the same time. I'll put out a rallying call for young people to go into STEM. We need more STEM people. But if I had to pick one, I'd say that I think we do need more data. I say this as a scientist, as a science background, but I think that we have more than enough to go on right now. If the IPCC reports any indication, we know what's going to happen. We know the risks that will happen in the future and what will happen if we don't take decisive action now. And if you need more of an indication, small islands are the canary in the coal mine. We know the effects that are happening right now at 1.1 or 1.2 degrees of warming. You can just imagine that what will happen at 1.5, much less 2.4, how catastrophic that's going to be. At COP27, the Pakistan Pavilion, this was something like a few weeks or a few months after the huge floods that Pakistan had that led to hundreds of thousands, I think it was millions of people displaced, thousands dead, including children. And Pakistan decorated their pavilion with a very somber quote. It said, "What goes on, what happens in Pakistan, won't stay in Pakistan." It's horrible. We know that these effects are happening now to developing countries. And sooner or later, we're all going to feel it, including the developed countries who are further from the equator, because climate is changing. And coming back to the original points, I think we need to act on what we have right now to make that decisive action to prevent those potential risks from happening. Because what is happening now, I don't want other people to experience. It's absolutely horrible that a single overnight storm could lead to you losing your homes. You could lose family members, lose your pets. I have 8 cats, and what would happen in a hurricane? And I have 8 cats to corral. What if I lose one of them or lose all of them? And I don't want other people to know that kind of anxiety or that grief from losing something that, you know, you've invested so much in. Overnight, people lose their entire homes. It's not just a material thing. This is, it makes you really vulnerable to lose everything.
Yeah. I think that's a point, just speaking a little bit to the global nature of climate change in general.
I think using missing data as an excuse, I think it's a really bad excuse. As scientists, we should be able to extrapolate from data gaps. It's a very important skill to have. And I can extrapolate that things are going to get worse. But I think it's also important to look at two sides of the issue. And for listeners who want a different perspective, the Stockholm International Peacebuilding Research Institute, I think that's the name, SIPRI, they recently put out a publication called 5 Urgent Questions on Ecological Security. And in that, they acknowledge that missing data could lead to incorrect policies. They're not tailored fully. It's a really good read. I would encourage people to read it. But it has not convinced me otherwise. I think that we need to act now.
Yeah, I think you make a good point that although we can always use more and better data, especially going forward in the longer term, but right now the science is very clear. We know the impacts of climate change. We can especially see how communities on the front lines have been impacted, and it doesn't stop there. So this brings us to the last question of the podcast today, and a little bit behind the scenes. We have already had this conversation once before, but audio technology was not on our side, which actually brings us to the point of quite a timely kind of update in terms of climate justice. Just happened last week. So I'm very happy to an extent, like, thanks for your time again, but to be able to pose this question and talk about this in our conversation. So just at the end of last week, at the very end of March, the General Assembly adopted a consensus resolution requesting an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice on the obligations of states in respect of climate change. And this has been seen, you can see all across every kind of social media site, different op-eds, posts across Twitter, LinkedIn, everything, that this is really being hailed as a huge milestone in a decades-long struggle for climate justice. So I guess this is relatively new It just happened last week, a few days before we're recording this podcast. There's been so much celebration across different groups, and it's very visible on things like social media. Do you also share in the celebration? And what do you think that this resolution could mean in the next handful of years ahead?
I think that it is absolutely going to pave the way for climate justice. We've seen the ICJ's inputs on the environment already. For example, cases on Costa Rica versus Nicaragua, Australia took Japan to court for whaling, and a few others. But as far as I know, I'm not an expert on international environmental law. We have not seen a case that is going to decisively place responsibility on states for their role in climate change. It's, of course, something that people have advocated for decades now, but this is going to be the first time that we will see it as a decisive court ruling. And I greatly welcome it, and I anxiously await to see what the trial is going to say at the end of this month.
Yeah, I guess by the time that this podcast is being released, there will be a lot more information about exactly what ICJ's ruling is and what their advisory opinion states. So I think this is a very good stay tuned. It's a very good sign going forward that a topic like climate justice and the obligations of states themselves is being discussed on this level. And hopefully this is a topic that we get to exchange a lot more about and also hear from you and maybe some environmental law experts as well. It's been really insightful discussing shared challenges faced by small island developing states, opportunities for cooperation, measures being taken in the Caribbean to achieve the sustainable development goals, climate justice, and of course, this new and hopeful development moving forward. Any other closing thoughts before we sign off?
This is unrelated to the discussion, but I would strongly encourage listeners to take a first aid course or take CERT training, that's community environmental response training. I have done both of those. My first aid has expired now, but I still know the important stuff. I am a CERT trainer for my local government, and I would encourage people to look into this because I'm sure we've all been in a situation where something happens very quickly and we start to panic. But knowing how I can take charge in that kind of situation, it gives me a peace of mind that I can help in some little way. So I encourage people to take the training, empower yourself so you can empower your community.
I think that's a great note of empowerment to close out on. So thank you so much for being here and joining us for this conversation, and especially timely given our postponement of this episode a little. So this was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We will be back with another episode in a few weeks. You can follow our latest updates on Twitter @ climatediplo. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, goodbye.